Okay, welcome everybody. Nice to have you all here, and it's good to see those of you who came to Pharmacist Day at the Capitol, I guess we're going to call it here. Or Pharma Day, or Farm Day, or... It was Farm Bureau Day, so there's some connection except for the... those are called homonyms, I think. Well, welcome anyway. We have 3.5 presentations today. We're going to be changing the order a little bit, the Medica presentation with the other half from the guest appearance. The unknown presenter will be taking with that. You'll have to all be, just to keep on the edge of your seats to see who that just might be. And we'll talk about the future at a break here. So I want to welcome, so it's, we're going to have a presentation from the Minnesota Pharmacists about some medication management work, which I think makes a great deal of sense. And they've got their best guide today, so that's pretty exciting. And then we're going to hear from Medica talking about some of their generic work, and they're going to talk about PBMs. And I think that we're going to spend a fair amount of time at the end on the PBM part, so they're going to go last. So we have some more time to fill up the balance of our time until we get sick of the discussion. So with that in mind, Isitz. Welcome. Is it Dr. Isitz?
That's correct.
Dr. Isitz, welcome to the committee. And you have free reign to tell us what's on your mind, and then we're going to ask you some questions. So,
well, thank you. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Chairman Abler, and members of the House Healthcare Cost Containment Committee for the opportunity to present the state of affairs relative to the delivery of pharmaceutical care, referred to by the federal government as Medication Therapy Management Services. My name is Brian Isitz, residing in Red Wing, Minnesota. I'm currently an associate professor in the Department of Pharmaceutical Care and Health Systems at the University of Minnesota, as well as serving as a faculty liaison for the development of a number of pharmaceutical care practices in Minnesota. Our senior vice president of the Academic Health Center, Dr. Frank Serra, has referred to me on a number of occasions as a clinical scholar in pharmacy, and I like that description. Now, I'll use the clinical scholar framework for presenting the data relative to medication therapy management services before this committee today. Now, before presenting the data on pharmaceutical care, let me take a moment to tell you a little bit about my expertise in this field. First and foremost, I am a pharmaceutical care practitioner, having cared for over 3,000 patients utilizing the consistent and systematic patient care process to identify and resolve approximately 10,000 drug therapy problems in the patients who I have served. The term pharmaceutical care first appeared in the literature in 1975, but it wasn't until a landmark article was published on this subject in 1990 that intense interest was generated relative to the prospects of this healthcare innovation. In 1992, the first pharmaceutical care demonstration project was launched, and that was right here in this state. 20 community pharmacies throughout Minnesota, ranging from International Falls to Red Lake Falls to Pipestone, and 17 other communities in between, participated in this $3 million demonstration project. I originally served as a research associate on this project during the early design and development, and then was invited to return to practice in 1994 at one of the sites. It was Red Wing Corner Drug in Red Wing, Minnesota, where I continue to serve as an affiliated practitioner. The results of this project were published in 1998 in this textbook titled Pharmaceutical Care Practice. Now, establishment of my advanced clinical practice credentials led to the next level of expertise, that being teaching pharmacists and pharmacy students how to provide pharmaceutical care at the highest level possible. Colleagues in the Peters Institute of Pharmaceutical Care at the University of Minnesota have trained and prepared pharmacists from all 50 states and 24 foreign countries on how to provide care using this healthcare innovation. I take great personal and professional pleasure in being invited to work side by side with my fellow pharmacists striving to re-engineer their practices, having visited some of the most beautiful places on earth, including 3 tours of duty to the country of New Zealand. Pharmacy students here in Minnesota have been learning how to provide pharmaceutical care for at least the last 10 years. A teaching innovation that I brought forward to the citizens of the state in 1997 was to utilize the university's what I call dental clinic model to create a pharmaceutical care clinic. And at the College of Pharmacy. In the School of Dentistry, patients come to the college, to the School of Dentistry, and receive their dental care from a dental student being supervised by experienced faculty. We now do the same thing for pharmaceutical care, where you, a relative, or a loved one can make an appointment to receive the service from a pharmacy student in the presence of experienced faculty. And I have distributed some of our copies of our clinic brochure for the committee members today as an informational item. So let's talk about the practice of pharmaceutical care. What is this service? How is it provided, and what are the standards of practice? I give presentations to literally hundreds of community groups, businesses, physicians, and others, and I found I get a whole heck of a lot further if I first explain what pharmaceutical care is not, before describing what the service actually is. From a consumer perspective, pharmaceutical care is not something a pharmacist does pursuant to dispensing a prescription. Repeat that. It is not something a pharmacist does pursuant to dispensing a prescription. It is a true healthcare service, separate and distinct from the business of distributing a drug product. Although I will say it still can be provided in a separate area of the pharmacy, but not as an add-on to dispensing. From a physician perspective, there are five things that pharmaceutical care is not. Number one, it is not pharmacists seeking independent prescribing authority. Second, it is not pharmacists engaging in therapeutic substitution on behalf of a pharmacy benefit management company. Third, it is not pharmacists changing a dose of prescription medications without the collaboration or input from the patient's physician. It is not an attempt to second-guess the physician's treatment decisions, and it certainly is not intended to negatively impact the physician-patient relationship. Then what is pharmaceutical care? It is a practice in which a practitioner assumes responsibility for all the patient's drug-related needs and is held accountable for this commitment. In other words, I take responsibility for everything that happens to you as a patient in relationship to your use of any and all drug therapies. There is a consistent and systematic patient care process with a defined beginning, middle, and end. And there are patient care process criteria and standards of practice so that society clearly knows when this service is and when it is not being provided. We can talk more about the state of practice during our question and answer forum, but let's turn to a discussion of the data in support of pharmaceutical care. Well, the short story is this. When a patient receives pharmaceutical care, they are happier, they are healthier, they are safer, and they cost the healthcare system less money. The societal problem driving the need for pharmaceutical care is referred to as drug-related morbidity and mortality. Drug-related morbidity and mortality costs this country over $250 billion with a B dollars every year. And that's on top of the over $200 billion that we spend just every year just to purchase those medications. So in other words, for every dollar we spend to purchase a drug, we spend another dollar at least to fix the bad things that happen when patients take medications. Now the reason for this deficiency in our healthcare system is not due to the fault of any individual healthcare professional or healthcare corporation, but as pointed out in this Institute of Medicine report titled, To Err is Human, it is due to a systems failure. In other words, prior to the advent of pharmaceutical care, there were no systems in place when a patient took a drug product home to ensure that they achieved all of their intended drug therapy treatment goals while avoiding or minimizing the adverse consequences of using that drug. Today, we do not have to accept inferior outcomes or adverse drug events as a natural cost of doing business when drug therapies are used by the citizens of this state. When the standards of practice and patient care process criteria of pharmaceutical care are applied, the data indicate that a lot of good things happen. And the framework that I'll use to present the data fall within these four categories: effectiveness, safety, quality, and cost. And the body of research supporting the improved drug use outcomes that I will discuss today is represented by over 300 published articles. When I refer to effectiveness of care, I'm talking about measuring improvements in achieving goals of therapy or clinical benchmarks, as well as improvements in patients' perceptions of care. When practitioners provide complete and comprehensive pharmaceutical care services, there is no question that there are significant improvements in goals of therapy achieved. In one national study involving about 400 patients with cardiovascular disease, conducted from 96 to 98, which included four pharmacies here in Minnesota, it was found that 62.5% of patients achieved all of their lipid goals or cholesterol goals. And to provide you with a point of reference, only about 25 to 40% of patients at risk for cardiovascular disease typically achieve their cholesterol goals of therapy. Another interesting project took place in the city of Asheville, North Carolina, referred to as the Asheville Project. The city administrator of Asheville, Mr. John Mile, was fed up with double-digit annual increases in healthcare expenditures, particularly without a lot of evidence of concomitant improvements in patients' overall healthcare. And over the years, a group of pharmacists in Asheville kept asking Mr. Mile to let them participate in the care of his city employees. These pharmacists even went so far as to say that they would go at risk for the care they would provide. In other words, they said to Mr. Mile, "We will provide pharmaceutical care to these city employees without paying us up front, and we'll wait a year to demonstrate cost savings and improved outcomes before seeking payment." So in 1997, after Mr. Mile had tried a number of disease management and drug utilization programs, he finally said, "What do I have to lose? Nothing else is working." He asked the pharmacist to start providing care to patients or city employees who had diabetes and then begin billing their practices. The effects of this pharmaceutical care program were dramatic, and after 6 months of program implementation, Mr. Mile called all the pharmacists into his office. And he came back to visit the pharmacist, and he said that he was so impressed with the decreases in health care expenditures, improvements in clinical outcomes, and the overwhelming employee satisfaction with their health care that he decided to start paying pharmacists retrospective to the start of that program. Here in Minnesota, we have found that patients will typically achieve about 70% of their drug therapy treatment goals through usual care. But when pharmaceutical care is integrated into the delivery of health care, patients end up achieving over 90% of their drug therapy treatment goals. In regards to safety, I previously mentioned the state of affairs related to drug-related morbidity and mortality. Some of the most influential medical researchers, including Dr. Lucian Leap, David Bates, and others, have found that at least 60% of drug-related morbidity and mortality is preventable. When we work with patients to provide pharmaceutical care, drug-related morbidity and mortality is addressed as we work to identify, resolve, and prevent drug therapy problems. You heard me mention that I found and fixed over 10,000 drug therapy problems in the patients I've served. These drug therapy problems can range from dangerous drug combinations to moving the dose of a medication from morning to evening to avoid daytime sedation. We can also measure quality. There are clear and concise standards of practice and patient care process criteria to determine whether or not a practitioner is providing medication therapy management services. These standards can be applied as part of a payer's auditing and quality improvement program. In addition, we designed a study here where I actually measured the level of agreement among physicians with the decisions made by pharmaceutical care practitioners. I used the same methodology used by the Medicare program to evaluate the quality of decisions made by physicians, and it was found among this expert panel that they agreed with 94.2% of all decisions made by pharmaceutical care practitioners. I do have a copy of the study that I published in the Archives of Internal Medicine, and I have that here for reference if you wish. Now let's talk about the impact of pharmaceutical care on healthcare costs. Numerous articles have been published on the healthcare savings attributable to care delivered by pharmacists in settings ranging from hospitals to clinics to community pharmacies. I've often asked myself this question, though. Why are there so many studies related to the cost savings of care delivered by pharmacists? And although I may not like the answer to the question, the fact of the matter is that we are one of the few healthcare professions who have had to demonstrate cost savings before our service will be compensated. Part of the reason for this is that the profession of pharmacy allowed itself to become inextricably tied to the dispensing of a drug product. In the 1950s, pharmacy decided to include the cost of services together with the cost of the drug product as one dispensing fee. If the profession had elected to use a compensation system that separated out parts and labor, such as that used by the plumbers, we might not be here discussing this issue today. So we've had to learn how to deal with the state of affairs and how to do the work needed to prove our worth to society. I want to make sure that I present a balanced view of the cost savings literature. Not all studies of pharmacists' activities have resulted in cost savings. For instance, there was one study where a group of pharmacists received 12 hours of continuing education on asthma, and the other group of pharmacists did not receive this training. The researchers then looked at the differences in patient outcomes between the two pharmacies and found there were no changes in health status or cost of care between the two groups. Other studies where pharmacists focused on a single drug or disease of interest have produced similar results. But the common denominator in these studies is that there is no evidence that pharmacists adhere to any standards of practice or any kind of a patient care process criteria. However, when pharmacists assume responsibility for all of a patient's drug-related needs, there is evidence of healthcare cost savings. Now, rather than going through all the evidence of cost savings from the various private sector pharmaceutical care programs, I'd like to use these next few minutes of time that I have with you today to talk about the experiences and evidence from the other states' Medicaid programs. These other states' Medicaid programs include those from Washington, Wisconsin, Iowa, Mississippi, Florida, and Missouri. In the early Medicaid demonstration projects, we're talking going back to 1995-96, there was a tendency to tie the care delivered by pharmacists to dispensing of the medications. Projects in Washington and Wisconsin showed some trends toward improved patient outcomes and some cost savings, but these programs were plagued by restrictions on which patients could receive the service and on the modest level of provider participation. In the Iowa project, there were some promising findings in a limited number of about 1,000 patients, particularly in terms of the number of drug therapy problems identified and resolved. However, the cost savings data have not been available to date. Mississippi engaged in one of the first Medicaid demonstration projects and have been able to demonstrate cost savings, but the analysis was with a limited number of patients. A program in Florida was initiated in 1999, setting aside $900,000 to compensate pharmacists for care. 560 pharmacists from over 300 pharmacies participated through August of 2004. Claims data through this time period showed a significant return on investment and has resulted in expansion of the program to over 1.2 covered Florida Medicaid recipients. And the program in Minnesota is the last one that I'd like to discuss. The Missouri project has benefited from an excellent study design. There were 1,203 patients who received pharmaceutical care services. Patients eligible to receive these services were those who had complex drug therapy regimens or had at least one chronic medical condition. A control group with a similar number of patients was also used. Here were the findings. In the pharmaceutical care group of patients, hospitalizations were reduced by 45%. That's in comparison to the control group, where the hospitalizations increased by 11%. There were 10% fewer emergency room visits among the pharmaceutical care group as compared to the control group. Drug expenditures between the two groups were very similar, leading to a decrease in total medical expenditures of 26% in the pharmaceutical care group, with a 6% increase in total medical expenditures in the control group. In terms of actual dollars, this is what it means. In the Missouri study, among patients receiving pharmaceutical care, there were reductions in total health care spending of $6,800 per patient per year, while in the control group there was the anticipated increase of $2,954 per patient per year. Now, having said all this, what does this mean for the state of Minnesota? We've been working on this for a number of years. There are now bills in the House and Senate that have or will be introduced to provide medication therapy management or pharmaceutical care service to patients in the Medicaid program. Since 2001, we have been working closely with a number of legislators, the administration, healthcare stakeholder groups, and others to move this initiative forward. So rather than go belabor the point and go dribble on with the data, I'd like to stop and ask the entertaining questions at this time.
Thank you, Dr. Heiske.
You're welcome.
Good to stop dribbling at a good time. This is very interesting. Let me just clarify a few things for me, and the members, I think, will have some questions. So what you're telling us is that the medication manager, pharmacist, whatever you call the person, is it a PharmD that does this?
Mr. Chairman, when the question is it a PharmD that does this? It does not necessarily have to be. We have trained pharmacists, as I said, hundreds and hundreds of pharmacists. And an interesting result of the Minnesota project was that we had two pharmacists. One was 72 years old, the other one was 81 years old. Sure, we had to teach them some clinical knowledge, but they knew how to interact with patients to find out what needed to be done to improve the use of their medications. So that is not a prerequisite for pharmacists.
And so it would be the person that doesn't do the dispensing, though. Is that the kind of the common thing? Or
this would be
the
dispensing practices? You can actually be, for instance, here's how we do it in practice as we build practices, is that we'll actually set days, if you will, where we'll have appointments. So let's say it's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday from 10 to 2 when you start building a practice. So you'll set those as your appointment days. You'll have a separate and distinct patient care area. And then patients will make appointments, and so when the person comes in to provide that care, he might have been dispensing, or she might have been dispensing the prescriptions on Monday, but Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, they'll be caring for the patient.
And so, do you see this person one time, or do you see him this week, and you come back in 2 weeks?
The patient care process unfolds like this. There's an initial assessment of all their drug-related needs, everything that the patient is taking for any medical condition. There's a systematic process. Then from that, we determine if they're achieving all their goals of therapy and have no drug therapy problems, they're doing great. You know, it's like going to the dentist to find out you have no cavities. That isn't usually the case, however. So we do set, and then if there are drug therapy problems, we set a care plan to resolve those drug therapy problems. And based on the severity of those drug therapy problems, we then set a follow-up evaluation date to determine, you know, the progress toward achieving outcomes. So it is more than one visit.
And so you'd see them three or four times over a year then? Is that...
We could see a patient at least four times if they have many problems. We have patients that have 8 or 9, 10 drug therapy problems, or 25 medications or drugs, and it may require that length of time to see them, yes.
And then do you charge, I see the students have a fee, but what would the professional fee level be if you were, and I understand this isn't something that the plans are covering right now, but I think it seems like they kind of ought to. We could put a bill in about that. What's the general fee range?
Yes. Let me address, Mr. Chairman, it's called a resource-based relative value scale.
Yeah.
Just like in medicine, in pharmaceutical care, there are five levels of payments based on the complexity of the patient.
Right.
Going from zero drug therapy problems with one medication, one medical condition, all the way up to level 5 is a patient who is on 9 or more drug therapies for 4 or more medical conditions with 4 or more drug therapy problems. And that's the pay range. It is based on the intensity of the service we have to provide. So in the private sector, in the cash-paying patients, that could range anywhere from a low of $40 for level 1 all the way up to $250 for a complex level 5 patient.
And what kind of time would you spend just in the range of from the level 1 to level 5?
Let's take the middle of the road, the level 3 patient. The one, I would spend about 35 minutes with that patient, on average, face-to-face time, some additional time with research and documentation.
Yeah. All right. Well, that's fascinating. Members, Jefferson Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Let's see. Mr., is it Iford?
Iford.
Hey, I'm doing pretty good on the names today. I usually massacre them quite a bit. Would you go over again what the physician involvement is with this program, and as you go down a period of time, you know, does the physician still remain involved, or how does the liaison work?
Dr. Lassitz. Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuelson, thank you for asking that question, because that has turned out to be one of the most satisfying aspects of my job, is working with physicians. You know, we as pharmacists sit back and think, you know, physicians may not be human beings. They really are. And we have... And as we go to explain this to physicians, the physicians are number one, skeptical, and number two, want to see the evidence. And so we explain what pharmaceutical care is, but then how the care that we deliver is going to be integrated or help them deliver care to patients, how we'll help the patient get better. And so what happens is because of the fact that we now enter the medical care arena as opposed to the drug product dispensing arena, is that so for me to care for that patient, I have to collaborate with the patient's physician very closely. And so physicians become involved to the extent that as I find drug therapy problems, sometimes I need to go to the physician to work with them to resolve them. The data from over 60,000 patient encounters indicate that 75% of all drug therapy problems can be resolved without the direct involvement of a physician. But 25% of the drug therapy problems do require the involvement of the physician. And that's, you know, when I talk about where I don't have to go to a doctor, it's where the patient was prescribed an antidepressant medication and the directions were take one daily. You know, the person gets up, takes it every morning, has sedation. And so the physician hasn't said to take it, that you have to take it in the morning. Let's take it in the evening to alleviate that problem. And so that's the type of drug therapy problems that would not require the active involvement of a physician. So to the extent that what level of involvement does the physician stay with, we work together as a team amongst all our physicians. And whatever level of collaboration we need to resolve those drug therapy problems, that's what we work towards.
And Dr. Isitz, if you had a removal of medication, do you would have to have the MD say that you are allowed to take that away, or do you have some flexibility?
One of our recommendations was to consider discontinuing a prescription drug product. That would be done by the physician. That's correct. We would have to communicate directly with the physician.
And consultation with.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Other members? Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Isitz, how do you get reimbursed? I mean, you were talking about Medicaid demonstration projects, but do they reimburse for this, or how is that
yes,
done
thank
today?
You. Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, we do it by every means possible. Pilot projects, grants, cash-paying patients, and that's how we've been building our practices. We do have some demonstration projects and with the third-party payers and what have you, but right now it's the reason we don't have as many practices going as we would like to is there is not routine reimbursement for the practice of pharmaceutical care. That's what we've been working towards for the last 10 years.
I'm puzzled by that. This is kind of a new thing, I guess, but it seems like if there's such a mother load of money to be saved and better outcomes to be obtained, we can ask the two testifiers coming up after you about their thoughts on this, but do you ever thought about why they just haven't jumped on board to embrace your work and pay for it?
Mr. Chairman, I have a lot of thoughts on that subject.
Well, is there a short version of those you could give us? Is there a public version that's kind of...
Well, let's put it this way. Yes. Mr. Chairman, pharmacists have routinely rated first, second, and third amongst the most respected health professions in America. And then sometimes I think we're just too nice of guys. And I don't try to pat myself on the back, but you know what? One of the things we need to do is have our patients come forward on our behalf and demand the service. That would go a long ways. And if that's part of part of what we may have to pursue as we go into this legislative session as well. We've gone to all the third-party payers, and each one wants to see the cost savings demonstrated with their patients. And so we'll design studies to do just that. And we keep just moving forward in incremental pieces. There is one other reason I should probably mention this committee, is that let me see, I'll phrase this correctly so I don't offend the American Medical Association. We have not had professional service billing codes such as those used in the CPT manual, current procedural terminology. And we have been working as a group of pharmacists to petition the American Medical Association's CPT editorial panel to get our own billing codes. So that has been the two, I guess, the practical stumbling blocks have been the fact that we don't have billing codes and we don't have provider identification numbers. Well, the HIPAA and a few other laws have actually changed that. So we now have a petition in front of the AMA's CPT editorial panel to get medication therapy management service billing codes. It was a vote was taken at the meeting 2 weeks ago in Monterey, and we'll hear the results of that in the near future. This is scheduled to be a benefit included for Medicare patients January 1st of 2006 for a group of targeted beneficiaries, which are still to this date are not clearly defined.
And Dr. Ice, it's I would accept one of the arguments to be that this is something you should do anyway, and I kind of thought that maybe this would be something to cover at least in a tangential way, but I understand I'm a multi-doc, multi-pharmacy patient who sees an array of people from psychiatrists to post-surgical. They might buy hospital pharmacy stuff and be all over the place. Is that the main argument why they're not paying you as well, besides you don't know how the code to bill it?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if that's the reason why we're not being paid for it, but I think that that's an argument in favor of having a service because of the fractionation of our healthcare system. I use a corny nursery rhyme with my students at the College of Pharmacy. And look at our healthcare system as being a big glass ball or a porcelain dish, and when you drop it, it's fractionated, it's broken, and its pieces are all over. It's our job as a pharmaceutical care practitioner to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. And that's really the piece here in supporting it. But I don't think that'd be an argument against not paying us. It's just other factors.
That's Senator Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Isis, in your pharmaceutical care plan, do you give suggestions for generic drugs at all, or do you just essentially take pieces of the puzzle that are presented to you and then see how they all fit together, or do you bring in new pieces at all?
Dr. Isis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Broad, in our assessment, all right, we have the systematic process we go through: intended medical use, effectiveness of therapy, safety, and convenience. And if that medicine has an intended medical use, it's working for the patient, it's safe, and they can't afford that thing, you bet that we're going to recommend a generic or an alternative place to get the medication, yes. In fact, let me give you a short story with you, if I may, that at our pharmaceutical care clinic, I've got a record number of students enrolled this year, so we need a record number of patients. So I put a call out to the Minnesota Senior Federation. Well, they sent me a whole bunch of patients, and we've seen drug products that I've never seen before coming from many different countries. And that's part of what we're also working on, is say, if we don't know what the quality or composition of that drug product is, let's maybe talk to the physician about changing it. Maybe it's a brand name cholesterol-lowering medicine to a drug in that category that's available generically. So that is something that we may seek to do to help save the patient money as well as to improve their health.
But since you seem to get the last question.
Thanks. Well, and it's really more of a request, Mr. Chair. You mentioned during your presentation that there's, you know, $2 billion spent, I think, on pharmaceuticals, but then there's $2 billion plus in additional costs related to that.
Dr. Eisen.
Did I hear that right?
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Thiessen.
Thank you, Thiessen.
Yeah.
Is the number is $250 billion on drug-related morbidity and mortality.
And what is that, Mr. Chair? What are you talking about in that term?
Drug-related morbidity and mortality includes death.
Yeah.
As people are disabled by medications, the extra burden on our healthcare system, hospitalizations, emergency room visits, all of these contribute to drug-related morbidity and mortality. It's been a fairly substantially studied area.
And if we could get documentation on that, that would be interesting.
Dr. Isis, we'd like to read.
Mr. Chairman, I actually have two noteworthy articles. First in 1997, and then a follow-up study was done in 2001 that actually documented this, and I'd be more than happy to do that.
If you can get those to Jason, my LA here, and also your testimony, if you wouldn't mind, just you can get that set up, the members, for those who weren't here.
Sure.
I appreciate coming, and members, I have a bill on this very thing, and it's going to be coming up sometime, so in the full committee, so it won't be in, it's under the, I think, in the medical assistance department.
Mr. Chair,
Representative,
I have one really quick question.
Yeah, you get the very last question then.
Do you set up clinics at your local Cub grocery store?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Samuelson, we'll care for patients anywhere we can. All right, and actually, it's funny you should mention that. We're actually taking a group of students to the Salvation Army next week to care for patients there. So we will actually do this community outreach and take our students or other pharmacists and set up appointments at other locations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Should be calling you, Dr. Ice. So thank you very much. And if Ms. Coleman wants to come down now, we're going to... Let me just go through the... in your packets, members, you'll see some stuff here. There's a folder like this. And if, in the audience, if you didn't get one of these things, you can get this Medica, which I could check, a $10 copay, and you can have this folder all for yourself. Judy Cook, if she's here, is selling the Xerox generic versions for $3. Those are available. And there's also some notes with this. Then you're going to see in your packets, you're going to see some PBM stuff, which we'll get into that. There's a couple of Thiessen articles that members have that the audience doesn't have all those because we got them a little late, but those are about pesticides and some environmental things. You'll see something that came from ACN, which is a management group for chiropractors of all groups, and they talk about what they've done with their some of their evidence-based chiropractic work, and they saved a bunch of money in that, which is very interesting, and this is... I got this as a provider. I don't know if they're hoping I'd pass it out, but it's being passed out. So you can see what their manager work has done, and it's kind of really interesting to look at some of the ratios. Then I'm promoting this Athens project, which is an event you might have got the notice of, but it's about technology and all that. There were electronic records is coming up sometime soon. You got that ad in your thing. This Warfarin article is kind of interesting. It says why they may or may not have gotten warfarin, which is apparently a good idea if you have a heart trouble. Talking about why people do it, why doctors do and don't recommend things. It may seem like they didn't do the right thing, but actually they thought about doing the right thing and they did it, and it was not part of the standard of care, but it was the right thing for that patient. Here's a nice boilerplate article about health care costs. A couple articles about insurance affordability. Ann Chesty wrote me a note asking me to bring it to the committee. Just as an example, about issues about hello medic, you happen to be here. We're talking about people who are no longer in a network that they thought they were in. I don't think it mentioned any particular networks, thank goodness. Anyway, so that's for your perusal. Alina had some ideas they had in their packet that had some cost containment ideas that aren't outstanding, but there's some ideas. Here's the chamber promoting its Smart Buy Alliance to its members, and we're kind of talking about what people are doing. So I'm just giving you stuff. Here's the AFL-CIO has some legislative agendas, including healthcare stuff. Is that what I had that there? Oh, and this, this is about, there's a couple articles about health partners in here. The workers authorized a strike because they didn't want to pay higher copays. I thought that was hilarious. And actually, they settled and they didn't have to pay higher copays. So I guess if you know on the inside, you don't have to suffer with those copays. The state employees weren't so lucky, you know, were we? Anyway, I'd pay higher copays. There's a thing about private sector options to Minnesota Care, which is a very interesting article. There's some other pieces here about quality. There's a whole series of those about report cards. And members, I'm not trying to bash report cards. I just want them to be smart and well done. You don't want to use a measurement system that doesn't work or that creates outcomes you would like even less than the outcome you're trying to avoid. And so that's the purpose of all these next several articles. And then for those who want to do want to become actuaries, I'm learning about what we're doing across the state and across the country and across, this is mostly statewide or countrywide stuff. Some of the rankings of Minnesota where we rank in a lot of infant mortality, costs, uninsured. This came from a recent thing by United Healthcare, I think. And then we have some more Thiessen stuff here at the end, which is I suggest you all read. And that's the packet for today.
Hey, Mr. Chair.
Yes,
I just wanted to complete your comment on copays. I just want to relate a quick story. My son stubbed his toe the other day, and had I had 0% or zero copay, it would have been a lot cheaper to take him to the doctor than to put the 7 band-aids on it that I would have had to put on it. But because I had a copay, I actually paid for the Band-Aids rather than the doctor's trip.
Well, there you go. Well, welcome, Ms. Coleman. It's nice to have you here. And you have some, there was a PowerPoint presentation in your packets, too, as well as the full copy $10 version that you've got for us. So thanks for providing us. This is at no charge to us, so that's nice to welcome.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, thank you. My name is Danette Coleman. I'm the Director of Public Policy for Medica. And I know there's still a lot of people behind me, so I'll try to keep my comments brief here. But thank you for the opportunity to come and talk about a pilot project that Medica is in the process of implementing. And the project is aimed at increasing generic drug utilization in an effort to control healthcare costs. And so if you look at why are we focusing on attempts to increase generic drug utilization, I brought some information with me that shows the huge potential for savings in this area. In 2003, U.S. consumers spent $216 billion on prescriptions. And although generic drugs accounted for 51% of all prescriptions that were written, they only account for 8% of those costs. So obviously there's some huge cost discrepancies between generics and brand names. Based on medical data that we have, the average cost of a generic drug is $19 versus a brand name drug at $114. And to show how the potential for savings in this, at Medica, we are able to save $4 to $6 million for every 1% we increase generic drug utilization. As a matter of fact, in 2003 and 2004, we were able to save $25 million just through a program that incented individuals who are currently taking a brand name drug, when appropriate, to switch that to a generic drug. And that results in savings ultimately to those who purchase the health care. So if you look at one way that we currently try to control drug costs, it's through pharmaceutical benefit managers. And Medica, like other health plans, do use PBMs. There is certainly a lot of value that PBMs bring, but much of that value is through discounts, through value, or through bulk purchasing. And so we believe that although that does something to control costs, significant actually to control costs, we believe that there's another angle that we need to look at doing this to control costs. In our current model as well, providers don't have a lot of incentives to change their prescribing behavior, and providers don't really have easy access to information about what the drug costs are, what's the difference between a generic drug versus a brand name drug that they're prescribing. And so at Medica, we believe that efforts to control pharmaceutical costs are best achieved in the medical model at the point of care between the physician and the patient. And so a program that we've partnered with an organization called MedVantix. And MedVantix is an organization, I'm really the first of its kind, that provides point-of-care access to generic drugs for physicians and patients through the use of an ATM-like sample center, which is placed in the clinic. These provide physicians and patients immediate access to a 30-day sample of a generic drug at no cost. This is no cost to both the clinic as well as the patient. So the patients do not pay their copay when they receive the generic drugs through the sampling center, and the clinics, Medica and MedVantix, are covering the cost of the machines themselves as well as the cost of the drug. So currently, physicians, when you look at back, in the savings that we have previously found in 2003 and 2004, that was getting people to change from a brand name to a generic. The focus on this effort is to get people to walk out of a prescription with a generic prescription in their hands rather than starting out with the brand name when that's appropriate. This program includes 9 therapeutic classes of drugs, so it's antihypertensive, antilipids, antidepressants, and the patients, when they leave the physician's office, they have the 30-day sample of the generic drug, they have patient education materials, as well as a prescription.
this is what the machine looks like, and here's how it works. The patient goes in to visit with a physician. The physician, whether they decide their cholesterol is too high and diet and exercise aren't helping that and they need to put them onto an anti-lipid, the physician can go to this machine, dispense a generic anti-lipid, be provided with the education materials to give to the patient, and then the patient, as I said, then walks away with a prescription. So they ultimately do need to go to the pharmacy to fill the prescription after that 30-day sample. So currently we have this in four sites across. You see here we've got North Memorial Clinic in Brooklyn Park, Ridgeview Clinic in Chanhassen, the Hutchinson Medical Clinic, and the Buffalo Clinic. We have six other clinics that we expect by the end of the first quarter to have this program in. And then we also will be performing analysis of the pilot, and we'll be looking at a couple things in that. One, we'll be looking to see the clinic satisfaction with this program. Does this work for the clinics? Does this simplify and create more efficiencies for the clinics themselves? And then also looking at comparing these 10 sites with similarly situated sites of equal size and location, and has there been a change in the prescribing practice? Are we seeing that these clinics who have this available to them are prescribing a higher percentage of generic drugs over brand name drugs? So that's just kind of an overview of the program, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Well, thank you. So it's like a robo-pharmacist kind of, huh?
Yeah.
Anyway, so we have a question for you. Just could you comment for us about, we talked about this, about generics versus therapeutic equivalents. Just comment about that, and maybe Ms. Cook can talk about that. So that comes up all the time.
And I think actually, not to steal Judy's thunder, I think that was when she was going to talk about the...
Well, why don't you come to the table then? We can. Questions for Ms. Coleman? That's from Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Ms. Goldman, this is perhaps beyond here, but if you're into the generic drugs, then the next question is sort of best deals on generic drug, because there's some question about whether we're always getting the best prices for them. Have you done any study on that to see whether there's any leverage there?
Ms. Goldman.
Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, the information that we have from our claims data shows that there is a significant cost difference between the generic and the brand name. I could certainly go back and get more specific information about the volume purchasing of the generics, if that's what you're asking.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. What I'm saying is generic to generic. The cost actually of a generic. I have heard some pretty significant differences when you shop around in the cost of generics. And I'm wondering whether you have any experience in that.
I don't have anything, Mr. Chair and Representative Bradley, specifically that I could answer to right now. I'd be happy to get more information on that, but I would guess that Ms. Cook perhaps has some information on that.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I know I'm not on your agenda, but as we discussed earlier, I know folks do have some questions about the therapeutic substitution and therapeutic equivalent.
So who are you again?
I am with Cook Hill Gerard Associates. I represent Barr Laboratories, and Barr is a leading generic pharmaceutical company currently manufacturing and distributing more than 100 pharmaceutical products and therapeutic categories, including female health care, cardiovascular, oncology, anti-infective, and psychotherapeutics. And Ms. Coleman talked a lot about all the cost savings, and you have some information in your packet, so I won't go through that, and I will get to your, I think I understand your question, I'll answer that in a second, but first I just want to talk about real quickly about the three terms. You've got bioequivalence, and therapeutic equivalent, and therapeutic substitution. Bioequivalence is the FDA's requirement that the active ingredient of a generic drug be absorbed into the body and metabolized in approximately the same amount over approximately the same period as the active ingredient of the innovator drug. So it has to work the same way in the system that the innovator drug does. Basically, what the FDA has said, that a generic cannot differ from the brand any more than one batch of the brand can differ from another batch of that same brand drug. So that's what they mean by bioequivalence. Now, FDA-approved generics are bioequivalent and also therapeutically equivalent. Drug products classified as therapeutically equivalent can be substituted with the full expectation that the substituted product will produce the same clinical effects and safety profile as the prescribed product. Drug products are considered to be therapeutically equivalent only if they meet these criteria. They are pharmaceutical equivalent, which means they contain the same active ingredients, dosage form, and route of administration and strength. So there is really no difference between an FDA-approved generic and a therapeutically equivalent product. Now, therapeutic substitution is when you take and substitute a completely different drug that controls the same illness in the same way. Like Prevacid and Prilosec, they're in the same therapeutic category of PPIs, but different drugs. Both control acid reflux equally well. However, Prevacid is at a much lower cost. So I hope that answers your question. And I wanted to read it because I want to make sure I got it completely right, because it can get confusing. And Representative Bradley, is your question from pharmacy location to pharmacy location?
Representative Bradley.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Cook, yes, and for that matter, any of the sources. So that is perhaps mail order or whatever. Just that's just a specific generic drug.
Sure.
You go out and shop around.
That is true, that depending on where you may purchase your generic drug, there may be variations in the price. What's interesting about a generic is it is a competitive marketplace, as opposed to the brand where you only have one drug. And so it is very price sensitive in the marketplace. And so you may have different drugstores or whomever who is selling the product who may buy it in larger bulk or whatever. It is a very price sensitive, competitive marketplace. And so that is why you will get the difference in price in a generic like you won't see necessarily in the brand, because it is a competitive marketplace. You don't walk in and say, I want bars, generic, whatever. Where you would go in and a person might ask for a specific brand. Does that answer your question?
Enough for that one. I do have a question about the other.
Go ahead.
The therapy. Thank you, Ms. Chair.
That's the
Look, I mean, this is getting a little tricky, but I'd like to sort of test something, because I don't know for sure. I think I got bioequivalent, therapeutically equivalent, and therapeutic substitution was sort of at least three groupings that I heard you say. There's an area where we always run into controversy whenever we try to have some substitution or generics or whatever, and that's particularly in mental health area. Are there in mental health arenas the bioequivalent, which is, like you said, no more variation than batch to batch? And are there therapeutic equivalents? I mean, help me a little bit if it is, and I know this can be somewhat controversial, because as we try to figure out how to get the best value, it seems like every time we go into the mental health drug areas, we run into a lot of controversy. Any opinions?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bradley, actually, the FDA has been very clear that when it comes to bioequivalence with respect to the mental health drugs, that there is no... the same bioequivalent standards apply. So in a mental health drug, in order to be a generic, the same standards apply. It has to be bioequivalent. Now, there are instances where an individual may not... the inactive ingredient may affect an individual differently from the generic to the brand, but that, frankly, is very rare, and that's across the whole spectrum of generic versus brand. But the FDA has been very clear that they have to be bioequivalent. There is no difference in the psychotherapeutic drugs from any other drug category.
Okay.
I think it's in the materials.
Further questions? Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
It's a great 3 minutes. Good to have you down here. Oh, no, it's fine. It's very helpful. I'm just bugging you. Come on down, Paul. You're going to come down, Paul, or are you just going to bring your guest? This is productive. We're trying to just dissect some of these ideas, and now we're going to dissect the PBMs. So Mr. Cassidy's leaving the room. That's probably a bad sign. Is it Mr. Rowan or Dr. Rowan?
It's Mr. Rowan.
Okay. Better be fair here.
No. That's perfect. Thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to come and speak with you here today.
And welcome. I think if you have a presentation, I think we'll let you go through it. That would be your desire, and then we'll we have till a quarter after, and then this is our last presenter, so the time is now available for this topic, so we'll spend it all weekend, and appreciate you being here.
No problem. I'm glad to be here. What I wanted to do is spend about 15, 20 minutes today to, in very general terms, give you a sense of the role that PBMs play in the healthcare delivery system. I know there are a lot of questions about PBMs. They're, in many respects, a relatively unknown entity to most people in the healthcare delivery system. And quite frankly, they're an entity that 20 years ago didn't really exist. But they've risen to be a very integral part of the drug delivery system. So before I, let me just quickly, I think I got my slides a little out of order here. Let me tell you a little bit about Express Scripts. We are the nation's third largest PBM. We're a Fortune 150 company. We serve about 50 million Americans. Our headquarters are in St. Louis, Missouri. We have about 10,000 employees nationwide, but we have about 1,000 employees right here in Bloomington, Minnesota. A large number of them are clinical professionals, pharmacists who work in our programs. Our clients are large employers, large Fortune 500 companies, large managed care organizations, HMOs, state employee programs. The Department of Defense is one of our largest clients. They really span the array of people who pay for prescription drugs on behalf of their employees or beneficiaries, and they choose to contract with us. Let me point out, I handed out a couple of materials for you all here that you can take away and go into more detail on. One is a really nice primer on PBMs. It goes in a lot more detail than what I'll go into today. Second piece is one that talks about how PBMs are currently regulated in the marketplace, because there's a common misperception that PBMs are completely unregulated entities. And the third piece is specific to Express Scripts that answers some basic questions that people raise about PBMs in the context of our company. But one thing I wanted to point out to you is on the inside cover of this, it's the pledge that we make to our clients about the services that we're going to provide to them. And basically we say we make the use of prescription drugs safer and more affordable for people. And what we pledge to our clients is that we're always going to align our interests with those of our clients and our members. We're going to develop clinically sound formularies based on the evaluations of independent physicians. We're going to aggressively promote the use of generic drugs, support the use of clinically appropriate lower cost brand name drugs, never recommend switching a patient to a higher cost drug, provide our clients with a detailed disclosure of all our sources of revenue and our financial relationships with drug manufacturers, and always respect the physician's prescribing authority. And these are really the guiding principles of how our company works, and it's how a lot of other PBMs work as well. But let me just move on and just, like I said, give you a real quick presentation on kind of the role that PBMs play. PBMs today manage the prescription drug benefit for about 200 million Americans. There are about 60 PBMs around the country. They vary in size greatly. There really are three very large PBMs, Medco Health Solutions, Caremark, Express Scripts. But you also see PBMs that are owned by Cigna, Aetna, WellPoint, Anthem, large health insurance companies. There's even a small PBM here in Minnesota named Prime Therapeutics, which is owned by Minnesota Blues and some other Blues plans. So PBMs, while there are some large ones, it's a very diverse industry right now and still a lot of players in the marketplace. As I pointed out with Express Scripts, the same is true of the other PBMs. The clients vary greatly. Their health plans, their employers, their unions, the federal employee program uses PBMs. The new Medicare drug benefit, which will take effect in 2006, envisions using PBM-like entities to deliver that benefit. And as I pointed out, PBMs can be standalone or they can be subsidiaries of health plans. Actually, in some cases, retail chain pharmacies run PBMs, such as Walgreens and CVS. So it's a very diverse marketplace. PBMs play a unique role in the delivery system of prescription drugs, because, quite frankly, we're the only entity in the chain that's actually charged with lowering the cost and increasing the quality. In that role, what we really are experts in advising plan sponsors on how they can structure their prescription drug benefit, get the most benefit for their enrollees, while at the same time being conscious of the fact that they have limited funds to pay for those things. And quite frankly, they don't have to offer prescription drug benefit at all, so they're really interested in using those dollars as effectively as possible so they continue to do that. One of the things that we're able to do is really pool the purchasing ability. We have 50 million customers that we serve, patients. We can really pool that in our negotiating with manufacturers for discounts on brand name drugs and in negotiating with local pharmacies for the prices that they charge. We serve a unique role of really linking the pharmacy care system. We run very large data systems. And in fact, that's really the backbone of the business that we do. We literally process in real time, point of service, 1 million transactions a day in our company, people purchasing prescription drugs. It's very complex. It's not a paper system. It couldn't be a paper system. If it were a paper system, we'd grind to a halt. We also use a lot of clinically based cost management and quality management tools that help our clients achieve their goals in providing their prescription drug benefit for their employees. If you kind of look at the history of PBMs, they really emerged in the early 80s. And in fact, what really hastened the development of PBMs was passage of Medicare reform in the early 80s, the catastrophic benefit. One of the elements of that was that it was going to legally require pharmacies to have electronic claim systems. And everyone went out and bought electronic claim systems in anticipation of that, and then they actually repealed catastrophic because there was a senior backlash on it. But the infrastructure was put in place to set up these electronic payment systems, and PBMs kind of became the hub of that. And we really started out as being the central processing of claims. It made sense for health plans and employers to begin using PBMs to do that, because paying pharmacy claims is a lot different than paying medical claims. The volume's much higher, and the cost per, the dollar amount per transaction is a lot less. So you needed a system that was very cost-effective, very quick, and could handle a large number of transactions. And that's what PBMs really built. As we progressed through the 80s and 90s, though, our clients came to us and wanted to do more. As the cost of drugs began to increase, as the number of therapies available, drug therapies available, began to increase, they asked us to continue to try to rationalize that system and help them manage it. And PBMs throughout the 80s and 90s grew very large to the point where today 200 million people receive their benefit through a PBM. And they developed tools, more sophisticated tools as time came on, to help employers manage that benefit. I'll point out, in the mid-90s, there were some drug manufacturers that actually owned PBMs. That's not the case today. They're divested. I can tell you Express Scripts was never owned by a drug manufacturer, because we viewed that as a true conflict and something that did not make sense. It would not work. But as I indicated today, there are about 60 PBMs that compete pretty vigorously in the marketplace for PBM services. I could spend a lot of time talking about this slide. This first book that I showed you goes into a lot of details about these techniques that we use. But there are some just very basic things that we do to help people manage their prescription drug benefit. One of the most basic things we do is put together a formulary or preferred drug list. A lot of people have misunderstandings about what a formulary is and how it's developed. They think it's developed purely on cost, and that's just simply not the case. Good formulary, a sound formulary, is put together by independent health professionals who review the available medical literature and make a determination on what are the most effective drugs in any given therapeutic class. And those are the drugs that go on the formulary, the preferred drug list. Once you make that determination, though, it makes sense that if there's one drug that's the best drug in the class, and that's the drug you're going to use on your formulary, it makes sense to then turn around and say to the manufacturer, look, we need a price discount from you for this. Or even a better example is if there are two or three drugs that are actually very closely similar in their cost, in their effectiveness, and basically similar profile. Why would you have one drug that's $100, one that's $50, and one that's $25 that are all about the same? Why would you pay for the one that's $100? Why wouldn't you pay for the one that's $25? And that's That's the process of the formulary. It's clinically based, and it's first and foremost focused on what's the best clinically for a patient. But once you've determined that, you go out and negotiate the best price you can from the manufacturers for that drug. We actively promote generic substitution. We think it's one of the most important things our clients can do to control their drug costs and really make their dollars, their benefit dollars, go further in providing benefits to their employees. We help them figure out benefit structures that give people, for instance, the incentive to use generic drugs as opposed to brand name drugs. If you have the same copayment for a brand name as you do for a generic, as a consumer, you're going to probably choose the brand name drug. So you want to set up a copayment structure, an incentive structure that moves people to the most cost-effective way. It's going to give them the best care, good care, but it's going to help conserve or best use the dollars that the company has available to do this. Because of the extensive data systems that we have, we're in a unique position in the market to really know everyone's the profile of an individual patient's, all their drug use. Meaning if they're going to multiple doctors and getting multiple prescriptions, we have that data available, which really helps us basically do drug utilization review, which means that when we get a script in and we look at the profile of that patient and see they're also taking a drug that's counterindicated to that, meaning if you take these two drugs, it's really bad for you, we have the ability to send instant messaging to the pharmacy for them to ask some more questions about why that script's being written for them. And that's an important safety net that we provide. We also make available to our customers mail service pharmacy, which I know the pharmacy community doesn't like. The truth of the matter is mail service pharmacy is one of the most efficient way to fulfill prescriptions, 99.9% accurate, and on average, at least for brand name drugs, it's about 10% less expensive than in the retail setting. It's something we make available to our clients. They make the decision whether they want to use it or not. We don't tell them they have to use it. They decide whether they want to make available to their employees or not. Another important thing that we think is really the next frontier in our business, and that's electronic prescribing. There is a hassle factor right now at the pharmacy and the physician's office when someone comes in, doctor prescribes a drug for them, turns out that it's not on their formulary or it's more expensive for them than what is on their formulary. There's a lot of phone calls that go back and forth to get that resolved to the patient's best interest. Electronic prescribing is a system that allows that to be resolved almost instantaneously because that information travels directly to the physician at the point where they're writing the prescription, and they can make a decision about the best script to write at that point as opposed to having to follow up several days later. It's also an important way to improve patient safety and cut down on medication errors. That's something that's very important for our industry and our company. This next chart kind of shows the results of our work. This is national data on all people in private plans, basically every private sponsored healthcare plan. What it shows is that from 1999 to 2004, the rate of increase of prescription drug costs for those clients has dropped from about a 19% increase a year in 1999 to about 11% in June of 2004. Now, that still means that drug costs these plans' drug costs are going up 11% a year right now, but 5 years ago they were going up 19%. What we've been able to do based on our negotiating and based on the tools that we bring to the marketplace is cut that rate of increase in half in a period of 5 years and hopefully continue to drive that rate of increase down as we move forward. These next couple of slides, in fact, I'll just flip to the next one. It's a very competitive business that we're involved in. And what I want to convey in this slide is the fact that our customers determine the services that they want to buy from us. We put together formularies, make formulary recommendations. We develop a number of different tools that will help them control their costs. But ultimately, they decide if they want to use those things and how they use them. We don't make that decision. The customer makes the decision, and then we move forward based on their wishes to implement that. And the process that we go through to bid for their business is very competitive. and they basically design the program that they want, and they tell us the terms that they want that program provided on. We put our best bids in, and then they choose the vendor that they want to choose based on that. And it gets all the way to the point of issues like manufacturer rebates and how much of the rebates are returned to the customer, how much of an admin fee is paid, or how pharmacies are reimbursed. And those are all decisions that are ultimately made by the clients, and they strike a business deal with us based on how they want to do that. The way our president describes it is we put together a quiver of arrows, and our clients decide which arrows they want to use. It's not a one-size-fits-all thing. These last few slides are just evidence of the value that the PBMs are bringing to the marketplace right now. In the recent Medicare debate, many different proposals that were put forward, but the Congressional Budget Office looked at the proposals that were put forward, and in each case, when they were looking at it, they found PBMs had the ability to save a significant amount of money for the Medicare program. 25% in the bill in 2000, 30% in the bill in 2002, which is very similar to what it was eventually enacted. The General Accounting Office studied the federal employee program's use of PBMs and found that PBMs obtained discount prices significantly lower than those paid by cash-carrying customers. PBMs got better discounts than the pharmacies gave to state Medicaid programs. At the same time, federal employees generally enjoyed unrestricted access to prescription drugs, but they enjoyed the cost savings and the other benefits that PBMs brought to them. PBMs offered a very broad pharmacy network. On average, 90 to 100% of the pharmacies available in an area were put on the network and available for people to use. And enrollees in the program benefited from the DR programs that the PBMs implemented. A joint Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice report on PBMs showed that consumers with prescription drug insurance administered by PBMs save substantially on their drug costs as compared to cash-paying customers. They characterized the growth of PBMs as an important development in providing consumer access to prescription drugs. A study by PricewaterhouseCoopers, very consistent with our own internal company numbers and what the CBO found, PBMs generally save about 25% over what people pay at the counter in a retail pharmacy. It estimated that PBMs would save about $1.3 trillion in drug expenditures over the next 10 years in the marketplace. So in summary, and I'll take questions. I know I've covered a lot of ground here, but PBMs really do play a pretty unique role in the drug delivery system. Strong evidence that we do good work. We hold down costs. Our plan sponsors and our customers feel good about the work we do. They continue to use us. I think it's evidence of the fact that we basically are using private marketplace forces to get reduction in drug costs, get price concessions from manufacturers, and that is working. I mean, my CEO often says that if PBMs didn't exist, short of enacting price controls, you'd basically have to build a system that does the same things that PBMs do. You would go out and you'd try to negotiate discounts from the manufacturers, discounts from the retailers, and you put clinical programs in place. There are questions about PBM practices. Happy to discuss them with you. There have been suggestions on how to regulate PBMs, but I would argue that we need to be really careful here because there are some suggestions out there that would severely damage the ability of PBMs to do what they've been able to successfully do. So with that, I'll stop and I'll take questions from the committee.
Well, thank you. I got a couple, and I'm sure members have a lot, and we'll probably spend all of our time and discuss this more later. So would you say the bulk of your savings that you extract would be from the manufacturers? Because of your purchasing power?
There's the savings, if you just look at the price savings that we bring, separate from any kind of savings based on utilization, they come from negotiating with the retail pharmacies, discounts from their cash-carrying price, and then rebates that are received or discounts from the manufacturers.
So that's the supply side when you're buying it. And in the what kind of savings do you see? There's there's a number of pieces. One is the cost of the product from its original state, from the manufacturer. There's the dispensing part of it, and then there's a number of times it gets dispensed. I mean, you can just comment on the dispensing part and the number of times parts.
Well, from the PBM...
Does that make sense?
That makes sense. From the PBM's perspective, at least in the context of how we would work, say, with a retail pharmacy, we basically negotiate a discount from them off of AWP. Now, they purchase that from a wholesaler, and they engage in a negotiation with that wholesaler on the price that they're going to purchase it at. We don't really see that. What we see is the discount that we get from them. I'm sorry, Anna, could you just repeat your
Let me better back up a bit, because you would, as a PBM, do you negotiate with the drug company per se?
We do that as well.
So you do a couple things. If you mail order, you negotiate on your own. If you use a pharmacist, do they negotiate on their own then?
Yeah, as a mail order pharmacy, we negotiate just like any other pharmacy would with a wholesaler to get the supply of drugs that we dispense.
And a pharmacist that you contract with, it's a freestanding pharmacy in Ivanhoe,
right?
Somewhere, which is a big deal to us, keeping Ivanhoe Pharmacy open. Just those little...
Absolutely.
And so if you negotiate with them, they would have their own sources and their own...
They acquire their own stock, and then they basically strike a deal with us on what price they're going to sell it to us.
Is there a reason you don't let them buy through you?
I don't know that we've really thought about that.
Otherwise you have to squeeze their margin, which isn't very big. Just a thought. I'm just here to learn.
Yeah, no.
Because if Ivanhoe could buy through you, and then you're talking a little bit on behalf of you and Ivanhoe. Now that extra margin of economy of scale that Ivanhoe brings even gives you a better price. You haven't thought of.
We haven't really thought about that. I think that there are a number of different implications just about even the chain of custody of the drug product, you know, from one licensed pharmacy to another. I think you'd have to look at pharmacy law to see the feasibility of that. Theoretically, you're right. I mean, if you can bring that the bulk of all that together, you'll get an even better price from the manufacturers.
Because you said it's about 10% savings to do it through mail.
Correct.
Which involves probably part of dispensing, but also involves your volume of sale purchasing. So.
There's a greatly decreased dispensing cost in mail order because it's automated. And literally, we can, some of our best mail order pharmacies process 100,000 prescriptions a day. Again, with a 99.9% accuracy. So there's the efficiency in the dispensing. There's also the volume of the purchasing that comes through it.
Well, in this group, there's some people that are thinking about ideas, so we'll discuss this pharmacy Ivanhoe purchasing with you. And then on the, do you find as you manage on the pen being that was one of the discussions that's come up, do you find that that's different too? With your manager, do you get involved in the doctor-patient part, managing that or giving advice?
Well, like you said, in our principle is we want to respect that relationship between the physician and the patient. But that doesn't mean that there aren't passive educational efforts that we engage in. For instance, if we notice a physician that kind of is continually prescribing something that's off formulary for a patient, If the customer wants us to do this, meaning the employer, we might send a letter to them saying, did you realize that the product on the formulary for this patient would actually be a lower copayment for them, and if you thought it was suitable for this patient, you could actually save the patient some money by prescribing what's on the formulary as opposed to what you have been prescribing. But there's no financial relationship, there's no incentive that we put in place. It's really a passive educational effort that we put in place so that the physician understands the impact that he's having on that patient just from their pocketbook based on what he's prescribing. But ultimately, he needs to make, from a medical standpoint, the decision on is this still the best drug to prescribe for them.
Thank you. Members must have questions, I'm sure. Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I just need some clarification here. If I go to my physician and get a prescription, can I go directly to the PBM and have it filled, or what happens there?
If your benefit plan, I'm just Mr. Chair, Representative Samuelson, if your plan sponsor, if the state has a mail order option with the PBM that it offers, then yes, you could avail yourself to that mail order option, send your script in, and have the script filled by the PBM's mail order pharmacy. Otherwise, you'd want to go to one of the retail pharmacies that's available in the network that you use.
Thank you. That helped.
That's somebody.
You anticipate, Mr. Chair.
Lucky guess.
Lucky guess. Well, let me try to narrow down maybe just to a couple of questions. One of the frustrations that consumers have, as opposed to most healthcare transactions where one gets explanation of benefits, at least has some kind of picture of the cost picture behind it, even whoever's paying for it, but they still see it. It seems and feels in the prescription drug arena that there's none of that. About the only thing you know is what your copay is. And there are some of us who are trying, we believe that as we have more HSA products, more consumers involved, consumers are going to want to have more understanding. Are there ways to get better transparencies? And maybe I'll add just a little bit more as you think about that, because there's a lot of suspicions. When I talk to my pharmacist friends, frankly, they don't have a lot of good to say about many PBMs.
Mm-hmm.
There's a huge amount of mistrust. And there's anecdotal stories about, why am I being pushed into prescribing or dispensing this when I know that it's really not the right thing? I'm suspicious there's kind of a cozy little deal between the PBM and the manufacturer. The question about rebates, about where the rebates are and whether the rebates are hidden behind in the price or are they open to. So kind of weaving in the whole transparency, I think, because part of it could be in, to the benefit of PBMs to get better trust.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley, transparency is a term that's bandied about a great deal, and it means a lot of different things to different people. And you've talked about four or five different relationships there, the patient and the pharmacy and what they see, the pharmacy and what they think they see, in terms of the decisions that are being made, the relationship between the PBM and the client, and the relationship between the PBM and the manufacturer. Let me start with the rebate question, the relationship between the PBM and the manufacturer. And let's talk about transparency in that context. Who needs to know about that? Does the pharmacy need to know about that? Does the patient need to know about that? Or does the client need to know about that? And if the question, and if the answer is the client needs to know about it, what does the client need to know about it? And let me tell you how it works right now with the PBM and our relationship with our clients and what they know about the manufacturer rebates that we receive. We do not disclose to our clients our manufacturer rebate contracts. Basically, the piece of paper that details the rebate that we get on every single drug and the relationship that we have. We don't disclose that contract. That's trade secret information, and that's several courts have looked at laws that demand that type of disclosure and looked at it and said that's probably a constitutional violation of the takings clause in the Constitution. What we do with our clients, though, is they understand in aggregate all the rebates that are due to them, and they can make a decision when they contract with us to receive 100% of the rebates, in which case they pay us an admin fee for the services that we provide, or some say, I don't want to pay an admin fee. Instead, I want you to take some of the rebates. Maybe I'll give you 5% of the rebates or 10% of the rebates in lieu of paying you an admin fee. What the client does in that situation then is have the ability to come and audit us at the end of the year to say, okay, you promised to provide me 5% of the rebates. I want an auditor to come in and assure that I got 5% of the rebates. That doesn't mean, again, that we disclose the manufacturer contracts to them, but they do have the ability to bring an independent auditor in who comes in and can look at a sampling of the manufacturer contracts, basically do a statistically valid analysis of the transactions and determine, yeah, you got 5% of the rebates or no, you didn't get your share of the rebates, and then the client sits down with the PBM and we come up with a way to rectify that. So that's how we assure transparency with the client. Now, from the pharmacy's perspective, and say, I assume the example you're pointing out or thinking of is one where a PBM might suggest a change to a drug that, to the pharmacist, they'd say, that's more expensive than what the physician prescribed. Is that fair?
I'm sure. Yes, that is kind of intended, yeah.
Here's the problem. The pharmacist doesn't know the relationship that the client has set up with the PBM. The pharmacist doesn't know what rebates are being made available on, the discounts basically being made available on that drug. So while the retail price for that drug may look high, the plan may be getting and is getting a rebate that actually makes it lower than the alternative that was being suggested. I go back to the principles that I pointed out. We never recommend switching to a higher cost drug. Never. And our clients make the decisions which drugs to put on the formulary. And they make that decision based on knowing what the net cost is going to be for that drug. Meaning knowing at the end of the day, after I get my rebates and after the other arrangements I've made with you, this is what I'm going to pay for this drug. They make the decision to put that drug on the formulary. We don't make it. They make it. So to the pharmacy, it may look like the net cost is higher, but the truth of the matter is the client has looked at all of this and made a decision that this is the drug I want to put on my formulary because it's less expensive. And PBM, I want you to go out and basically encourage people to use the formulary because that's how I'm going to be able to save money in my prescription drug program. So I realize what I've given you is a complex answer, but I think the point is transparency means different things to different people in the chain, and there are levels of transparency that actually harm the ability to get discounts as opposed to appropriate transparency that gives, for instance, clients what they need to know to be able to design their benefit plan without running into that problem.
Somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe just one other. I think I have a sense of sort of the answers, and some of them don't surprise me, and there still remains, but maybe that's for another day. But you mentioned something about regulation.
Yes.
And that there's some wrong. Do you have any suggestions? Because I think there is sort of increasing pressure on public policymakers to consider some form of regulation. Do you have any suggestions of the right way to do it?
Well, Mr. Grum, what do you want us to do to
And always an interesting question, Mr. Chair, Representative Bradley. I don't have a direct answer to that question, but I would ask this question. Who's coming to you asking to regulate us? Are our customers coming to you to ask you to regulate us? Because I think in this area, similar to health plans and insurance, the purpose of regulation is to protect the end user of the product, from potential abuses. And to put a basic structure in place that makes sure that the customers of that client are relatively fairly treated. I've been involved in this debate in about 20 states, and I, walked through and listened to the proponents. Never once had an employer, a health plan, or any other PBM client stand up and say PBMs need to be differently regulated than they are. I'll be honest, it's been the people who we negotiate with and who potentially feel economically disadvantaged by what we do who have basically come up with the ideas on how to regulate us. So my answer to the question is I don't have an answer for how I would like to be regulated, but I don't think that it's best to have the critics and the people who are the negotiating partners of the regulated entity decide how we're regulated.
Chair, maybe just concluding, I suggest maybe thinking that we do have some proposals already as bills this year,
right,
that, for example, in terms of the disclosure, I think go way beyond the constitutional questions that you've raised, and I object to them personally, but it's a sign of something. And no. And the issues of regulation are also coming from sources that are constituents that we do listen to. So if there's any models out there of states that have done something the right kind of way, I don't know if it's this year, next year, the year after, but the pressure is mounting. And I guess that, I don't need an answer to that. That's just kind of my own reaction.
Well, and Mr. Rowan, and just to follow up on that as well, your own chart here is showing that you're down to 11% increase in the whole system, in the annual rates are down 11% per year. If your expenses in your company were down 11% growth per year, you'd be in trouble. And just funny things.
Yeah, no.
And so part of it is, as this committee is designed to dissect the issue of costs, if nobody talked to us
about where who we should look after. We're looking at everybody. With this fact, we don't want to cause any harm, and or we might by accident, so that's what you're here for. But I think in a system where employers are not funding coverage that they would like to do for fear of future cost increases, not for the current price, because they could afford the current price. They look at a system that's ramping up, it's down the road, it's in single digits now, but who knows what tomorrow is. There's projections both ways. And employers who are trying to survive in a narrow margin sectors are finding themselves unwilling to cover their employees. And where that affects this committee is we're charged to deal with a department that spends $1 billion or more a year, and some of those people spend that money here in the audience in the methods that we come up with. And it's consuming, it's got a 19% growth rate in biennium, the largest sector in the state budget. It's on our mind. And so those are, just so you know, and so maybe you found the ideal way to conserve some costs. So why would you do that? That's just the why, so you understand.
Oh, no, I understand.
Our motivation, it's purely hope. let's talk. Other questions from members? Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rowan, in your presentation, you talked a lot about the role and the unique role in the history of PBMs, and the presentation was very informative. Thank you. But in your business plan, what do you see for the next 10 years? What are you anticipating in regards to change for your business?
Mr. Rowan.
Mr. Chair, Representative, one of the things I mentioned was electronic prescribing, and I think that our industry will really want to champion the adoption of that technology. Now, there are many barriers to it. It's been difficult to get physicians to accept the technology in their offices for very understandable reasons. We need to find ways to remove those barriers. I think promoting the use of generic drugs is going to be very important for our industry, and it's one of our key strategic initiatives. Right now, our company has about a 51% generic fill rate, which, as you saw, is about average with what the country is, but actually for an insured population, that's actually very high, because when you look at the whole population, uninsured people generally tend to use generics a lot more than the insured population because of the incentives that are put in place. So that's very important for us. Beyond that, I'd say those are probably the two of the key things that we're looking at to help our clients and hopefully help improve patient safety, especially through e-prescribing.
Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't want to carry it too far, but let me just try a little bit, because even when I go, because I've been working with all level of providers, and trying to figure out what the numbers mean, and that there's a thing called AWP, which, as far as I'm concerned, is a number.
Right.
And it's about as arbitrary as it can be, and yet we hook our wagon to it. So as an engineer, pretty practical guy, I can't hook it to much of anything. Then I go to the physician making the prescription and suggest to the physician that, you know, it would be kind of nice if, as a part of your consideration for this client, that the cost would be part of it. Physician says, I don't have a clue. I don't have a clue. And these are some of the indicators to me that the whole system of the most rapidly growing portion, I realize it's not the biggest portion of a healthcare expense, but it's the most rapidly growing, in some cases for good reasons, because there's miracles, in some cases because somebody's advertised better than everybody else, and they get you to buy something that's 10 times as expensive as a solution that's 99.9% as effective. But this, you know, and I'm trying to be scientific about the use of the word transparency here. I mean, I guess what it boils down to, at the right transaction level, knowing that you can bring cost trade-offs, value trade-offs, into the formula. And it's almost a tragedy that even at the doctor level, and sometimes even at the pharmacist level, I said, come back here. Come back behind the counter, and let me tell you what the price is. It's about 15 different prices, really, because it depends who I'm dispensing it for. Oh, my God. And then, of course, the big tragedy that often comes out is the person that writes the check out themselves might end up being paying the most, which is the weirdest thing in the world. Because usually when you pay cash up front for something, you get the best deal. Now, that's kind of expressed in a ruling out sort of the frustration that we have such complete lack almost across the board at any kind of transaction level of information that should be part of the value judgment. And then, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any reaction. It's just sort of a little bit further explanation.
You have to solve it for us.
Chair Representative Bradley, you're absolutely right. We have a pricing system for drugs right now in this country. It's market-based. It is very confusing. We're one part of that, but there are many other players that are a part of it.
Absolutely.
It starts at the manufacturer. Now, the manufacturers actually set average wholesale price, AWP. And AWP is determined by a couple of different private agencies that go out and collect data on a daily basis on what kind of the price any given drug product is selling for on that day. Unfortunately, it's really the only reliable benchmark. Maybe I use the term reliable with quotations, but it's the only benchmark that's out there right now. It is complex, and I think that, you know, there are many different marketplace transactions that are taking place here in negotiations, and that's where it gets to be, that's where there are 15 different prices, and that's where it gets to be difficult for some people in the chain to necessarily know and have all the information to say, well, this is really what the cost is. You know, one question is, does that person in the chain really need to know that? Does the person further up in the chain know it, like the client, and do they know what they need to know to make an informed decision or not? I mean, in an ideal world, transparency sounds like a wonderful thing, but short of setting price controls, government-set price controls, when we then know what the price is, in the marketplace and the complexities that are there right now, this, unfortunately, is something I think we're going to probably have to live with for a while.
Let me just, we're almost out of time. Let me ask one more question, and then we're going to use this has been productive, and you may actually be invited back to do more of this in a little larger committee in the same room. Could you discuss drug therapy management? You've got about a minute to offer us a comment, but you heard the presentation before. Do you use something like that, and does it seem like there's some merit in that to you?
Many of the things that we do are similar to that. For instance, we do have databases in place that generally basically do let us look at someone's whole prescription drug profile to say how, you know, example, people that take TOX2 inhibitors, Celebrex, Baxtra, they take them because it's supposed to reduce abdominal bleeding. Well, we look at their drug profile and we find out that they're also taking generic Advil, generic ibuprofen, which can cause GI bleeding. So we're in a unique position to do that kind of analysis because we've got access to that data, and you say, well, wait a minute, you can't, it doesn't make sense to take the COX-2 inhibitor if you're also going to still continue to take the ibuprofen. We don't do it in the same way that the pharmacist described, but we do many of those same things.
More of an overview, you might say. Okay, well,
yeah.
This is. I think we're out of time. Unless someone has a question, I just can't stand not to ask. I appreciate coming. This has been productive, and I'm, you know, if you want, if someone wants to pursue the idea about could Ivanhoe buy with you, that's an interesting idea to float. Members, we're going to meet again next Tuesday. Thank you. And then I apologize for the Wednesday thing. You can blame the House on the bonding thing. But so we'll be back to Tuesdays pretty much on a regular basis. Two more weeks of these kinds of presentations, and then we'll be getting into some bills. So thank you very much. Members, we're adjourned.